Day after day, for over a year, I saw no one except my family. It was a family like none that you know. But I'm a mother, it seems, and these are my children. And soon enough, like all children, they'll leave home, and I suppose my heart will be broken. But for now, this is my life as a turkey.
Joining us now is wildlife artist and naturalist and turkey mother, Joe Hutto. When Joe says he talks turkey, he's not kidding. He spent more than 2 years, well, about 2 years, as the full-time parent of a flock of young turkeys. What started as an informal science experiment changed his life in ways he could never have imagined. Joe is the author of Illumination in the Flatwoods, A Season Living Among the Wild Turkey. He's also written about his study of wild sheep in the book A Light in High Places, and he's currently working with and studying a herd of mule deer in western Wyoming. A documentary recreation of Joe's experience raising a flock of wild turkeys will be broadcast on Nature on WOSU-TV tonight at 8 p.m. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Hi, Ann. It's a pleasure to be here.
Wild turkeys are no longer an endangered species, but they are elusive. I have actually seen them in North Carolina from the balcony of a place I was staying at up in the mountains, and they would come out at a certain time every day. You see that many people who live in areas where they are abundant never see them.
That's very true. In parts of North Florida where I conducted this study, I knew many people that had literally never seen a wild turkey, even though they're considered to be abundant in those areas. And, of course, there are areas in North America where turkeys are abundant, and people see them every day because they're in open country like South Dakota, places like that.
I don't know how they compare to the domestic turkeys we eat at Thanksgiving because, of course, nobody really sees those turkeys anymore. They're in those giant buildings, and we don't really know what they look like. But the plumage and everything on these wild turkeys was really the real deal. That's the stuff that the pilgrims talked about. That's the stuff that we imagine when we're kids.
Well, that's absolutely true. And wild turkeys are, they have many wonderful attributes, but they are just dazzling, absolutely beautiful. When you see a truly wild turkey up close, it's a true phenomenon.
I'm still trying to figure out how you got the bowl of wild turkey eggs. Did everybody know you were looking for some wild turkey eggs, and how did they wind up on your, you know, on your porch?
Well, I had been doing imprinting studies casually and seriously as a scientist for decades, and I'd always considered that wild turkeys, because they're what they call a precocial bird, would be a very interesting study, but yet they're very hard to come by. Wild turkey nests are just about impossible to find without radio collars on hens. And I was living on a large quail plantation in North Florida. They were doing a mowing operation and started destroying wild turkey nests inadvertently. And I just casually mentioned to one of the farmers there, if he came across another nest, that I would like to get the eggs. And so I came home one afternoon, and here's a dog bowl full of eggs on my porch. And I was not prepared. I didn't have an incubator, and so I just raced out and put together what I could, and immediately realized this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and I was going to make the best of it. And so I just invested myself totally.
Joe Hutto is a wildlife artist and naturalist. He is the subject of a film that will air on PBS on WOSU tonight at 8 p.m. It's called My Life as a Wild Turkey. He narrates the film. He's also the author of Illumination in the Flatwoods, which tells the story of his life with the flock. Do they call him a flock of turkeys?
Yes, I think so.
Okay. So, imprinting. Why is imprinting something that has fascinated you so much? Why is it something you've invested so much time in above and beyond the turkey experience?
Well, I started as a child. I got very interested. I was sort of one of those kids that was a congenital scientist. I couldn't help myself. And I started experimenting, raising very young wild animals, mammals that were so young that their eyes weren't open yet, and birds, of course. And precocial birds are birds like ducks, geese, swans, and what we call gallinaceous birds that are chickens, pheasants, quail, turkeys, certainly. And precocial birds are born fully alert and fully ambulatory, and as soon as they're born, they leave the nest, and as opposed to altricial birds, which have to be cared for weeks or even months before they can leave the nest. And so precocial birds, the imprinting phenomenon is very strong, very powerful, and it occurs very rapidly when they're born. It has to. And so as soon as they come out of the egg, they identify essentially the first living thing they see as their parent, because it's a very precarious time for them. And so evolutionarily, of course, it's important to identify that mother, get with the mother, and off they go, and they leave the nest actually as quickly as possible because of predation.
Is the word precocial related to the word precocious?
Absolutely, yes.
Because that's a big theme throughout the story.
Well, it is. And young precocial birds, they're aggressive. They feed themselves. The mother does not feed them. The mother protects them from predators. She shows them the lay of the land. But they're capable of actually feeding and taking care of themselves.
To our listeners, if you have a question or comment for Joe Hutto, wildlife artist and naturalist, we're talking about his life as a turkey mother. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Now, before they hatched, you did make sounds and vocalize. Did you know that was part of the process and something important?
I did. There was a pioneering researcher with wild turkeys. His name was Lovett Williams, and Lovett lives in Florida, and he did most of his work there, and he was the first to put radio transmitters on wild turkeys, and he was very interested in their vocabulary, which is extensive. And one of the things that he did, he put radio collars on hens, and so could find turkey nests, which are, of course, hard to find. And he actually put microphones in the nest. And what he observed was that as the eggs became more and more developed over time, they would begin to vocalize, and the hen would start actually making sounds to the eggs. And the eggs, you could distinctly hear that they were responding. And so his theory was that when the young wild turkeys hatched, that they were already imprinted on the wild turkey hen's voice. And so I wanted to see if that was actually occurring. And so I began actually talking to the nest, which was a little embarrassing. And so I would make sure that no one was around. And I would turn the fan off in the incubator, and I would start making turkey-like sounds. I had the ability to approximate a wild turkey's voice. And I would make these utterances to the eggs, and interestingly, the eggs would actually respond. I would start to call, and they would answer me. And they would continue to answer me for a short period of time, 15, 20 seconds, and then they would literally grow tired and become quiet.
There were little turkey.
There were well-developed turkeys inside the egg,
right,
after about 25 days. I think the vocalization started about 20 days. And they're actually alert and aware inside the egg for at least a week, maybe 10 days. And so they respond to the hen. And so when they hatch, they literally know your voice. And that became very clear. And the documentary actually explored that in beautiful detail. They captured that perfectly.
What was the emotional impact for you in that process? It was a scientific experiment for you, but it became a little bit more than that?
Sure. When you raise baby animals, it's impossible to remain impartial. And also, I think that the observer gains a better insight by literally becoming parental and actually falling in love with the young animal a little bit. And it makes them, in some ways, seem more more compelling and more interesting because of this affection that you have for them. And so you invest more of your time and more of your awareness and more of your attention. And so in that sense, it lends you a keener insight.
You want to be, you know, a natural turkey mother, but you also don't want to anthropomorphize them. That seems like, as I watched the film, it seemed like a real fine line.
Well, I hope that's something that I accomplished. People have told me that I have, and that there is a fine line there between science and sentiment. And one thing we need to understand about the anthropomorphic analogies is that all organisms share similarities. And in that sense, human beings are similar to many other animals. We share similarities. And so it's not inappropriate to identify those similarities and make comparisons. And so in that sense, being anthropomorphic is not inappropriate.
Tell us about some of the characters that stood out in the film and for you as well among the 16 turkeys.
Well, they do. Wild turkeys are very intelligent creatures, as we know many birds are. They do have a misplaced reputation for stupidity, and they're not at all. And one of the results of that extraordinary intelligence is they have wildly varying personalities, and some are shy and some are aggressive. Some are very affectionate. Some are not particularly affectionate. Some are curious and have very individual interests that they pursue that other turkeys don't find compelling. And so in that sense, I came to know each turkey as an individual. And, you know, I guess to make an analogy, if you had 20 Labrador retrievers as pets in a very short time, even though they superficially look very similar, of course, you would identify every one of them very easily, not only by their appearance, but by their personalities. And that's the way it was with the wild turkey.
My guest is Joe Hutto, wildlife artist and naturalist, and we're talking about his story. He's written a book about it, Illumination in the Flatwoods. It's the inspiration for a PBS documentary called My Life as a Wild Turkey. When we return, we'll continue the conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Newt rallies while Rick Perry flubs.
Oops.
Healthcare finally gets its day in court, and President Obama tells the deficit super committee, get it done.
Go ahead and bite the bullet.
I'm Brian Naylor, the political junkie. Ken Rudin and Neil Conan are back. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation is this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 54 degrees with cloudy skies in downtown Columbus, a high of about 55 today. Clouds tonight and temperatures falling to 31 degrees. A few clouds for Thursday and then gradually becoming sunny on Thursday afternoon, a high of 44.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Ohio Department of Health. The Ohio Medical Reserve Corps is looking for medical and non-medical volunteers who are ready to help Ohioans when disaster strikes. More details at ohioresponds.gov.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Joe Hutto, wildlife artist and naturalist, and we're talking about his time in the woods as a turkey mother. He's written about it. It's called Illumination in the Flatwoods, and it's also the inspiration for a PBS film, My Life as a Wild Turkey. If you have questions or comments for Joe Hutto, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's listen to another scene from the documentary when the wild turkeys are about 3 months old. Much of your daily outings with them are hunting expeditions for insects and berries.
I feel a little like an anthropologist who, after immersing himself in an exotic tribe, is becoming confused about his own social identity. I haven't started eating grasshoppers yet, but the smooth green ones are beginning to look pretty tasty.
And I just wanted to say, in the film, the actor who plays you,
right,
kind of stands in for you while you narrate.
That's right. That would be Jeff Palmer.
Jeff Palmer, he does consume a grasshopper, like, in two very distinctive bites, and I wanted to know, oh, my God.
All I can say is, Ann, that it never happened.
Okay.
But there was an element of truth in that I became a part of that culture. I tried to insulate those turkeys entirely from the human experience. And so, in that sense, they were never near another human being. They were with me, but I was very careful to insulate them as much as possible from my culture. They had a certain expectation, a vacuum of expectation, I called it, where they expected certain behaviors from me as a turkey mother. And so I tried to conform to that. And in a short time, they taught me what was expected of me. And so they could behave like wild turkeys and not be confused about my presence. And as a result of that, I only spoke their language. And I lived with them every day, sort of 24 hours a day. And I had no other contact. And so in some sense, I had this strange experience of feeling as if I was becoming a part of their culture and not so much just the fly on the wall. And that was my original position that I wanted to assume was this impartial observation where I didn't interfere and I didn't participate. Well, they demanded that I participate, of course. And so there was an interesting moment where I realized that I was watching them eat, I was watching them hunt, I was watching them explore, and I had this strange, interesting desire to participate in that, and I realized at some point that these smooth green grasshoppers were starting to look pretty good to me.
It was amazing how they ate the bugs, the way they darted out, and we it did remind me of something from Jurassic Park, and Mike and Marion called in and asked, are birds like wild turkeys, descendants of the dinosaur?
They
look ancient. They look absolutely prehistoric.
Well, they are ancient, and they are like little velociraptors. Mm-hmm. And I had that revelation one day that these things look like little dinosaurs, and they are aggressive predators. They're omnivores, of course, but they're also aggressive predators. And they eat an interesting variety of things. And the younger the turkey, the more inclined they are to eat animal protein. And so they begin eating small insects in large numbers. And then as they grow, they expand that into all sorts of things, frogs, lizards, mice, if they can catch them. I've actually read of wild turkeys destroying and eating other ground nesting birds. So they can be voracious predators. And absolutely, as all birds are, they are ancient. And these birds, if you look at the paleontology and the osteology of these birds, they're essentially unchanged in 20 million years. And as we know, evolution is never static. And so even though the wild turkey was sort of this perfect form early on, they have been honed to a razor's edge over this 20 million years. And so there are many things about wild turkeys that are truly extraordinary because they are such ancient, well-developed creatures.
Sarah on Facebook writes, I used to fantasize as a child about living with a family of rabbits that lived in my grandmother's backyard. I am just wondering, is your guest a vegetarian? Could he ever eat turkey after doing this experiment? Just curious.
Well, a lot of people are curious about that. And you know, I grew up in a hunting culture, and I am grateful for that because it way of exploring the world, and that's the only way I can explain it. And I was actually a very good hunter. I was predisposed to be a hunter, as I think human beings are. But absolutely not. I could never kill another turkey, and not because I object to the process. I am not a vegetarian. I have been a vegetarian, and it didn't suit me well. I was working very hard in college, and I was a vegetarian for a couple of years, and I didn't understand complete proteins, and I wasn't eating right, and it actually was very destructive to me, and so I stopped being a vegetarian, but I'm very conflicted about it, and I would never kill another wild turkey. I don't object to people hunting turkeys.
Mm-hmm.
But I could never shoot one again. I love them too much, and not only that, but more importantly, I find a wild turkey alive is so valuable to me that the small amount of meat that it would put on my plate is completely out of proportion to what they represent to me as living creatures. Does that make sense?
Yes, and I want to reiterate the glory of their plumage. It really brought me back to sort of those fantasies as a child, but that you never really see it anymore. It's always sort of a picture on a napkin, you know what I mean?
That's true, and there's, birds, as we all know, are spectacular often,
mm-hmm.
and wild turkeys are extraordinary, to see a truly wild turkey in a wild state in the sunlight is, they're just absolutely dazzling. Extraordinary creatures.
You know, back to food for a minute, you aren't able to eat much in the way of human food when you're around the wild turkeys, when you were around them, most days. You said one of your happiest times was when blackberries were in season. So what did you eat?
Well, they are omnivorous, and as they mature, they start eating more and more plant food, and in particular, they rely heavily on berry crops, and where I was doing this study, there are a lot of what they call ericaceous plants, and those are things like blueberries and gooseberries, and so gallberries. And I found that when the blackberries were in season, that I ate blackberries with the turkeys. When it was blueberry season, I ate the blueberries, and I actually relied heavily. Wild turkeys do feed themselves, the young, mm-hmm. but they also pay close attention to what the mother is doing, very attentive to her. And so if I did carry a little day pack with me, and I kept a camera in there and tried to keep food. And what I found was anything that I pulled out of that pack, the birds were obsessively curious about it. And so one, it sort of interrupted their natural behavior, which I didn't want to do. And if it was food, they naturally assumed that it was food for wild turkeys. And so I would essentially get mobbed, and they would eat my sandwich or whatever. And so I found that the only thing that I could carry during the day were apples. And I would casually pull an apple out of my pack, and I could eat it while I was walking along with the turkeys. And, of course, they became aware of that, too. And so if I got to eat half my apple, I did good.
It was interesting how interested they were in some things. In the film, there is a carcass that looked like of a deer,
mm-hmm.
but really mostly just bones left.
Right.
And they were fascinated by that. What do you think? What are your theories about what they're thinking?
Well, it's hard to say, but they are obsessively curious about many things. Wild turkeys have extraordinary curiosity about everything in their environment and things that don't facilitate their survival directly. They just want to know what's going on in the world, and they're interested and playful. They find strange artifacts. You know, if there's cartridge brass or old glass from ancient house sites, Aboriginal pottery, flint, they actually found arrowheads and would start playing with them. Aboriginal arrowheads. Fascinating curiosity about things, and not only that, particular turkeys would have particular interests. And so I tried to explore that. that. And of course, it's hard to extrapolate and think, well, you know, what is this behavior and what is this wild turkey thinking? But they're very playful, and they have the incredible curiosity about everything in their environment.
My guest is Joe Hutto. He is a wildlife artist and naturalist. He is the author of Illumination in the Flatwoods, A Season Living Among the Wild Turkey. He's also written about his study of wild sheep in the book A Light in High Places. A documentary recreation of Joe's experience raising a flock of wild turkey will be broadcast on Nature on WOSU-TV tonight at 8 p.m. If you have any questions or comments for Joe, he will be leaving us in about 8 minutes. So get the calls in, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You decided to raise the wild turkey away from any other human contact, and you are married, right, still?
I was married at that time.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And
how did that? What did that do for your relationship?
Well, I paid dearly. This was this study was not funded. It was something that I had wanted to do all my life. I had done many imprinting studies in the past with many different species of animals, and because I was in college or working in the field on other projects, I was never able to fully invest myself in one of these studies, and I'd always wanted to do that. And the Wild Turkey Project came along, and I decided, okay, I'm going to try to do this 100%. So I actually built a little enclosure out in the forest, away from the cabin where we lived. And so the young wild turkeys never encountered other human beings. In a year and a half in the field, we never saw one person. And so in that sense, it worked out perfectly.
In this scene from the documentary, the turkeys are growing to sexual maturity, and the male turkeys begin to challenge one another. Let's listen.
The males will need to fight their way to the next stage of their lives. Only the toughest will get to mate. And as these practice bouts show, when the real fighting starts, it'll be ferocious.
As the turkeys begin to need you less as a parent, how did your relationship with them evolve at this time?
Well, it did change. And, you know, originally, of course, I was a parent. And as our relationship evolved, and I think this is true in all wild turkey families, the hen eventually becomes integrated just as another member of the group, and she may still have some dominance, but after 6-9 months they just become a flock of turkeys. And so in that sense, they matured to the point where they no longer felt like I was in charge, like I was the parent. And so they just allowed me to become one of the group, which was really the best case scenario for me. That was the observation. That was the perspective that I wanted. And so I was allowed to accompany them. I was not a distraction. I could become the fly on the wall and observe true wild turkey behavior, not with a pair of binoculars from 50 yards or from a concealed blind, but literally walking next to those turkeys and seeing the species of insects that they were selecting, hearing their specific vocalizations to identify a very specific species of snake. And so I gained a wonderful insight into their behavior and their life that I could have never had from any other perspective.
Murph in Grove City, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Murph.
Thank you. I'm wondering about the imprinting. Do you feel this can occur with other animals?
Absolutely.
I mean, for instance, like a squirrel.
Yes. Well, I started imprinting squirrels when I was a child. And
that's old hat, right?
That was one of my first experiences, and I imprinted many of them. And I would get squirrels. I would literally rob nests when I was a child, so I could get a squirrel that was at the perfect age and it had gotten the colostrum, the milk from the mother, So its immune system was strong, but yet it hadn't opened its eyes yet. And mammals imprint slowly compared to birds, precocial birds. And so it can take days or even weeks to fully imprint. But squirrels are extraordinary. You know, they have a neurological architecture because of the ecology, the environment they live in. They have this three-dimensional architecture in their brain that is not unlike arboreal primates. And so their intelligence, there are certain similarities to ours in the type of structure. And squirrels are extraordinary. And they were a revelation to me as a child, and they probably changed my understanding more than any other species. And as we all know, if you've ever had a bird feeder and you've tried to keep squirrels out of your bird feeder, well, you realize they're a lot more intelligent than we are. I can't keep one out. So they're fabulous, and absolutely all mammals, to one extent or another, imprint.
Thanks, Murph, for that call. John in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks. I was just wondering, like, if you take two baby pigs out into the woods and let them raise themselves, within 2 weeks they become wild swine.
That's
if
right.
If you would get turkeys from a farm or baby turkeys, would you be able to do the same thing?
No, you wouldn't, actually. There have been studies years ago when turkeys were very rare, they were endangered. There were actually government programs to introduce turkeys into the wild, and what they found was 100% wild turkeys were almost impossible to raise in a pen for various reasons because of their wildness. And so they started breeding them back to domestic bronze turkeys. And so a 50-50 cross could not survive in the wild. A three-quarter wild and one-quarter domestic turkey could not survive in the wild. 7/8 wild and 1/8 domestic turkey could not survive in the wild. And so any part of that domestic gene, when it got confused with the wild turkey gene, was it took that adaptive razor's edge that they have off. And they were incapable of surviving for a long period of time. Now, sometimes one or two might last for a year or two, but typically they will not survive.
Thank you, John, for that call. Joe Hutto, I want to thank you for joining us today. It's been fascinating.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, Ann. Thank you very much.
Joe Hutto is a wildlife artist and naturalist. He spent almost 2 years with one or more of about 16 wild turkey. After imprinting them at birth, he's written a book about the experience. It's called Illumination in the Flatwoods, and a PBS television special, My Life as a Turkey, will air on WOSU-TV tonight at 8 p.m. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back and talk about what else? Raccoons. On the next Fresh Air, how tax cuts became a focus of Republican policy, what the impact has been, and a look back at why Republican presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush raised taxes. We talk with Tim Dickinson, political correspondent for Rolling Stone. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Friday night on WOSU-TV, the PBS Arts Fall Festival continues from Cleveland with Women Who Rock. The show delves into the talent required by women rockers to make it to the top, and the program tells the history of great American females whose work not only brought down the house but broke down barriers as they struggled to obtain both artistic and economic equality. Watch PBS Arts from Cleveland, Women Who Rock, Friday night at 9 on WOSU-TV. 54 degrees in downtown Columbus. Showers are likely this morning. Cloudy skies this afternoon, a high of 55. Clouds for tonight and a low of 31 degrees. And those clouds stick around for part of the day on Thursday and then some sunshine later in the afternoon. But chilly, a high of just 44. Clear skies Thursday night, a cold night with a low of 26 degrees. And looking ahead to Friday, sunny skies and a high near 50. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
With special cameras, we enter the hidden, intimate world of a young raccoon family to see how this raccoon mother's careful teaching transforms her helpless kits into self-reliant scavengers. Urban raccoon populations are exploding, and city life is changing raccoons in some remarkable ways.
That's a scene from a new documentary that follows urban raccoons in Toronto, Canada, also Germany, and even Japan to discover why a former woodland creature has adapted so well to city life. Joining us now is award-winning science and nature filmmaker Susan Fleming. Her documentary, Raccoon Nation, will be broadcast next year on the PBS TV series Nature. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, Ann.
Also joining us is one of the urban wildlife researchers in the film. Stan Garrett is an associate professor of wildlife ecology at Ohio State University and a senior scientist at the Max McGraw Wildlife Foundation in Chicago. He's an expert on raccoons and other mammals, and his research focuses on urban systems and the dynamics of wildlife disease. Welcome to the show, Stan.
Hi, Em.
You know, Susan, truthfully, we were interested in this show and doing this show before we knew that, lo and behold, one of the people in the film is right here at OSU.
And one of the world's experts.
Yeah. I mean, who knew? Much of this film occurs in Toronto, which is referred to as the raccoon capital of the world. 50 times more raccoons live in that city than in the surrounding countryside, which is amazing. But what is a typical city like? About how many more times raccoons live in, say, Columbus than in the countryside?
Well, I think Stan's probably apt to answer that question, or able.
Stan?
I think it's pretty safe to say you'll have pockets of 20 to 30, 40 times the raccoons. So the densities in some of the most desirable urban habitat are absolutely fantastic for raccoons, and they respond very strongly to that.
So why are they so attracted to cities? Why aren't they out in nature, you know, washing whatever it is they wash and eat in the rivers and the streams? What do they want to live in a garbage can for?
Well, I think city life, I think one of the things we explore in the film is how city life might be making raccoons smarter. It's certainly making them fatter. It's an easy life for them. Food is readily available. Places to den up are readily available. And so one of the things that Stan's exploring is what that city life is actually doing to raccoons and to their physiology. But I think it's pretty clear that it's if you have your choice, it's an easier way to live. And humans found that out, too. So I think raccoons are following the same model. What do you think, Stan?
Oh, yeah. So your question is, why are there so many raccoons in those cities? And they have an easy life, so we're providing some of the best food for them. I mean, they love jelly donuts, for example.
Or the best or worst food, depending on your point of view.
Depending. Mm-hmm. So very easy food to acquire, much easier to find because garbage is very dependable. You can find it pretty much in the same place, same time, all the time. Whereas out in the natural world, they have to go out and seek constantly changing types of food that will change seasonally. So it's very easy for them. And then the biggest thing is the really important predators of raccoons don't occur, at least in the city, or at least their biggest predator, which is us, changes dramatically as you move from the country to the city. So they're not hunted and trapped as fur bearers in the city where they are extensively in rural areas.
If you have a question or comment for our guest, Stan Garrett, he's an associate professor at OSU School of Environment and Natural Resources, and also Susan Fleming, she's a filmmaker for PBS Nature, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We are now talking about raccoons. We're still in nature, but now it's about raccoons. Why is research about raccoon behavior so challenging? How much do we really know about them, Stan?
There's some things we know you know, pretty good, such as their food habits and things like that. But there's other aspects of their ecology or their behavior that's still a complete mystery. Even after decades and decades of research, we still don't really know how they function socially. We're trying to explore that. And there's a lot of other aspects in terms of their physiology and even their relationships to us. We don't entirely understand. Plus, as Susan's film kind of illustrates, our relationship with them is changing every year. It's a constantly evolving story, and so that's why it's always interesting to continue to work do research on them.
But Susan, what you do is you film them at night with the night cameras, and that was kind of weird because it made me think about the next time I'm out on my patio, who's lurking in the woods, you know.
There is a whole hidden world going on at night in cities that most people never see. And we were out on city streets at 2, 3, 4 in the morning. And we were really in a raccoon world. I mean, especially in places like Toronto, they rule the night and they're everywhere. And the more we filmed them and the more we had hidden cameras and we really got into their world and were able to follow them quite intimately, the more impressed by them I became. I mean, they really know how to take on a city.
I was very stressed out at the part where they're trying to climb into that little shed. The mother's trying to teach the babies.
Yeah.
And I wondered, you know, I don't know if you were there or who was there, but do they feel like they wanted to kind of go, here, let me just give you a little boost here.
<'Cause> it took everything to just stay behind the camera and not go help. And it took a long time for that whole scene to unfold. It was probably over an hour. It was from darkness right into daylight, and you could just hear the city wake up and people moving about and dogs start to bark, and you realized, you know, they might rule the night, but in the day, they've really got to get out of sight. They got a lot of competition, and the people who lived in that neighborhood had no idea they were living in that shed for months.
Yeah, they're telling the dog to quit barking, you know, shut up, what are you barking at, that kind of thing. Stan, there's something about that makes one of the special things about raccoons are their paws, their front paws, and the nerve endings there. Can you tell us about that and why that's important?
Yeah, it's one of the unique features of raccoons compared to other mammalian species is that they have this incredibly sense of touch in their front feet. And that is a product of an increased nervous system, sensory system along those paws, the ridges on their what we would call their fingertips. But accompanying that is they have to have a place for all those nerve senses to go. And so it's actually their cerebral cortex is increased or enhanced in size to be able to receive all that information. And so what you have is this animal that now is adapted for hunting for food primarily through their feet. And there aren't many mammalian animals that do that.
Yeah, we just talked about turkeys in the last segment, and one of the points was made that in 20 million years, they haven't changed, barely at all. But raccoons are changing very quickly. What is changing about them? Actually, their brains.
Probably their brains. Obviously, that's one of the difficult things to measure geologically. So, in other words, we can look at their bones through time, but it's hard to measure changes in their brain. But what we're finding is that the brain responds very quickly to stimulation. And so they are stimulating the brain to varying degrees in different types of habitats. And it turns out, and that this is what I think Susan is arguing for in the film, is that we provide them with a rich, environment in the city with which to explore novel systems, and that provokes stimulation, which increases or enhances the development of the brain.
And one of the things that was really fascinating for us with the film is that we explored that idea not just in Ohio or in Toronto, but we also went to Japan, mm-hmm. where, you know, raccoons are invading 1,000-year-old temples, and to Germany, where there's a city called Kassel that has the largest raccoon population. And all over the world, this same kind of adaptability is happening, and they're formidable creatures. They're really taking on every environment and succeeding.
It's kind of scary what's happening in Japan.
Yes. I mean, these are, you know, wood structures that have withstanded wars and, you know, forests encroaching in thousands of years, and raccoons are destroying them. And the Japanese are up in arms. They really, it's a tough battle to take on because raccoons are very smart. So they have a zero tolerance policy towards them. But even at that, it's a tough situation.
You know, I always thought baby raccoons were cute, but the Japanese took that to another level at some point. There was a cartoon on television. It influenced people. Tell us about why raccoons ended up in Japan in the first place.
Oh, there was a cartoon called Rascal the Raccoon, and one of the scientists in the film talks about how the Japanese fell in love with Rascal, and they began to import raccoons because they're so cute, to the tune of thousands a year. And now, you know, they've stopped the importation, but they have a massive raccoon problem. Because they just proliferated, and they're so adaptable, they can move into different, you know, countryside and cities, and find places to live and things to eat. You know, they'll eat almost anything, and they're just really street smart, you know, things to contend with.
Yeah, you're at these Buddhist temples, and they have traps set up for raccoons. It's kind of a strange contrast.
It was really odd. You know, these serene.
Yeah.
Beautiful places where, you know, I always have this vision of Buddhists don't hurt a fly.
Yeah.
But no problem setting up the traps. You know, the monks were helping us film and, you know, they were setting up their traps every night. And I think in large part, it's because you have to get ahead of it. I mean, you really, if you're going to have a zero tolerance policy, you really need to have a zero tolerance policy.
But really, can you ever eradicate something like that once it's gotten a foothold, no pun intended, Stan?
It's very difficult. And raccoons, again, going back to their learning ability, eventually they learn and they respond to what we're trying to do. So that's one of the biggest challenges as far as managing those animals.
And, you know, we cannot build a garbage can that a raccoon will not eventually figure out how to open, right, Susan? I mean, that's something you talk about in the German example.
It's an escalating arms race. I mean, we make a change, they take some time, figure it out, and they have very long-term memories. And I think that's one of the interesting things that Stan has been studying populations for over, is it 25 years, Stan?
Yeah, something
so
like that.
The longest-running studies, and it's really impressive because you have to be studying them, an animal like this for long periods of time to be able to track that adaptability. But I know here in Toronto, it's just a big business to come up with a raccoon-proof garbage can, and it never stays on the market that long. It's always, you know, they always figure it out.
Why are raccoons and their interaction with dogs and cats a problem, Stan?
Well, the biggest thing that we're interested in is the possible transmission of disease to those animals. Raccoons not only are generalists in terms of the habitats they use and the foods that they eat, but they also are a generalist in terms of the types of diseases that they can carry. So there's a wide range of certain pathogens that we call zoonotic diseases that can be transmitted to people and pets. And so that's the easiest way for us to be exposed to raccoon diseases is actually through our pets. And so that's what we're looking at right now in terms of our research is how much interaction occurs and how easy is it to actually transmit certain diseases across that wild to domestic spectrum.
Susan Fleming, what was it like to record their actions? They can be dangerous.
They can, but for the most part, they know what they're doing. They know where they want to go. They're so used to people. That we're not a real, especially in cities, particularly in cities, we're not a real big threat to them. So we didn't really have a lot of, you know, confrontations. It wasn't a big worry. But I think that what was difficult was how bloody smart they were. They kept, you know, figuring out where we were or where the cameras were, and they would avoid us. And, you know, there's so many opportunities all the way down a street for them. It's easier for them to hopscotch, you know, a block or five or six houses to avoid you to get on with their business. So it was, you know, we had hidden cameras and motion sensor cameras set up, and a lot of our footage is taken secretly because we had to try to outthink them. And I'm humbled to say it was no easy task.
Rob in Blacklick, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Rob.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. And this my question or comment ties in, I think, with the recent turn of discussion here. A cousin of mine had through a strange set of circumstances, wound up raising a few little raccoon kits. But he was explaining to me that he was very careful to make sure that they were released before they were too old. Even though they were very playful, very sociable, as infants or young, he said that overnight they can become viciously feral. And I guess I'm just calling to find out if there might be anything that would indicate raccoons are socializing with us a little bit better. Obviously, well, thank you.
You mean that we could ever have them as pets?
They don't make good pets.
but the question is, could they ever make a pet?
No, I don't really have any interest at all in having a raccoon.
Okay. I thought that was your question. Okay.
I'm just kind of curious about the feral aspect of a being, and they're dogs took millennia to socialize with man or wolves. I'm kind of wondering about the evolutionary aspect as it pertains to raccoons in the present day.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you very much, Rob. So
I've met, I had, during the course of the filming, met lots of people who had raised raccoon kits. And it was one of the things that you really have to know what you're doing. It's not, these are not pets, these are wild animals. And I kept saying that again and again to people, because they do turn. There reaches a point and overnight they become the wild creature that they are. And it's dangerous business. And I think we need to respect what they are and leave them to their own ways. How about you, Stan?
Oh, yeah. Once they hit their teenage year, basically, they're not a whole lot different from our own kids.
I was going to say, wait a minute, what are you describing my kid?
They don't like their parents anymore.
We have an email from Sharon. She says, I live almost downtown, and my backyard is like Wild Kingdom. We continually have to have raccoons, possums, and groundhogs removed from our garage. Our neighbor has a live trap, and he put it out for 12 nights in a row last year and caught a possum each night. We relocated them outside of town, which I guess brings up the question, are there other animals out there, critters out there, like raccoons that are in the same way, adapting? Stan?
Well, with opossums, that's a good example of an animal that also is found pretty commonly in our cities. And, in fact, we do a lot of work with opossums as well. But there's a stark difference between opossums and raccoons. Raccoons are actually figuring out how things work. Opossums aren't figuring anything out. They're just simply there. So there's not the cerebral work that's going on in the mind of an opossum that you find in a raccoon.
Any wildlife interactions, Susan Fleming, that you noted in the Raccoon Nation?
Well, I think one of the most fascinating ones for us is when we put cameras inside Stan's research stations and we're able to show him for the first time, because it's pitch dark. So we were filming in infrared, and we were able to show him for the first time interactions between raccoons and cats and raccoons and possums. They've for a long time been able to do it with a sort of scientific cameras, but we were able to take HD cameras in there. And I found that particularly the interactions between cats and raccoons fascinating. I mean, how much they tolerate each other. And the more I thought about it, I thought about the importance of Stan's work, that no one has sort of explored how much these animals cross paths with each other and have these relationships, because most of it happens in the dark and out of sight. And it's a whole hidden world, isn't it, Stan?
Totally.
Susan Fleming, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Susan Fleming, filmmaker for PBS Nature. You can see her documentary Raccoon Nation next year on PBS and WOSU-TV. And Stan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
You bet.
Stan's an associate professor at OSU School of Environment and Natural Resources. Thanks for listening. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus. And streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7, NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.